All right. Anyways, we're going to take a look at what starts a whole process. There is what starts a whole process that leads to this very long story that we've looked at from other perspectives in the past, which is the marriage between Yitzhak and Rivka. We've looked at the difference between the way that Yitzhak tell the way that the Eved tells the story, and the way that the story is presented in the narrative. We've looked at why the Eved's name isn't there, and his identification with Eliezer, and why that might be the Midrashic identification. And we've looked at notably the point of view issue of who he is in the eyes of everybody else and in the eyes of Rivka, and what possible deception may have gone on there. But we never looked at this problem, which is the issue, the statement of Avraham that starts the whole ball rolling. And this entire mission starts because Avraham does not want Yitzhak to marry, well, let's see who it is he doesn't want him to marry. All right, so we'll start with this. We have Avraham Zaken Ba Bayamim, which, by the way, important to note, means is a phrase that's used several times. We find it with David, we find it with Yeshua. Avraham Zaken Ba Bayamim means he's old and his days are coming, means he's about to die, or at least he thinks he's about to die. All right, it turns out that he's certainly got at least 35 more years to go, maybe 36, could be, but he's not close to dying, but he thinks he is. That's what drives this. Adonai berachat Avram b'kol. In the meantime, he's got a golden retirement. Vayomer Avram el avdo zakan beito. So Avram turns to his eved, who is the elder in his house. Now, zakan here is not a chronological statement. It means he is the one who's in charge of all of the stuff in the house. Hamoshel b'chol asher lo. So you could call him a CFO, but that's a little difficult because he's an eved. And as long as he's an has a status of an eved, which is a very clear status, it's not just a vocation. It means that Avram has in his household Avadim, and there's one Eved who's put in charge of things, not very different than Yosef in Potiphar's house. What does he say to him? Simnai adcha tachet yirechi. And just a short moment about this odd phrase, where he says, put your hand under my thigh, and then vashbiachan, I'm going to make you take an oath. What's that about? And by the way, we see it in Pasuk Tet at the end of this vignette, when vayasam et yado tachet yerech Avraham Adonav. He puts his hands or his hand under Avram's thigh and makes this oath, which means putting the hand under the thigh is a critical piece of this puzzle about what's going on. So just a word about that. We have the famous Midrash, Rashi quotes it, that he had him put his hand under the thigh because when you take a shvuah, you want to hold on to something that has kedusha, typically a sefer Torah, tefillin, and since there were no mitzvot yet, and the only mitzvah was brit milah, take it from there. However, there may be something else going on here, and that is has to do with the fact that Avraham is Zaken Ba Bayamim, because this exact request happens later on in Bereishit, at the very end of Bereishit, which is when Yaakov says to Yosef, "Simnai adcha tachet yirechi, and take an oath that you won't bury me here; you'll bury me back in Hebron." So these two are very similar. And what is their similarity is that they are both fathers who are anticipating death soon, and they have a post-mortem request of their person who's in charge to do something on their behalf that they're afraid won't get taken care of because they'll be gone. It's clear that Abraham can't handle this job himself. As we'll see, it's a big job because he's too old. All right, and so what is the symbolism of putting your hand under the thigh? So we actually have this from other Near Eastern documents. This was a method of taking an oath that was sort of similar to, I'm sure you've all done this before, a trust fall. You know, we've done this in camp and in bonding exercises for work, or a gibouchon, as we call it, is you stand there and fall backwards and somebody catches you. And it's a total trust thing. But it's a similar thing. When you're putting your hands under somebody's thigh, the symbolism is that they're sitting on you. And the idea is that they are fully dependent on you, and it heightens the severity of the oath that's taken, that this is an oath that the person administering it will not be around to make sure gets fulfilled, and therefore you symbolize it by holding them. And the same thing that Yosef puts his hands under Yaakov's thigh, to indicate you can totally rely on me that I'll bury you when you're not around to see to it anymore. I'll bury you back in Hebron. The same thing here. Abraham is concerned he won't be around for Yitzchak's wedding. He wants to make sure that it happens with the right girl. Okay. Vashpiacha. So I'm going to administer an oath to you, meaning I'm going to make you take an oath. Ba'adonai Elohei Hashemayim Ve'Elohei Haaretz. Right? So Avram perhaps has to explicate who God is to this Eved. We don't know who this Eved is, and we don't know what his understanding of theology is, but he's clearly invoking God. Asher lo tikach isha livni, you may not take a wife for my son. So the sense is he's going to be the sort of the executor of the estate, and part of his charge will be to find a wife for Yitzchak. So do not find a wife for Yitzchak. Mi b'not ha-Kna'ani. And that's the question in the shir, why not? What's wrong with b'not ha-Kna'ani? But he adds another descriptor here, which is Asher Anochi Yoshev Bikirbo, that I dwell in their midst. And that's an important phrase because, as we all know, this is the famous story where Yafasi Chatan Shel Avdei Batei Avot, this is the famous story where the entire story gets repeated later on when the Eved comes into the house and they give him food. They said, I'm not going to eat anything until I tell my story. He says the story. Etc., etc. And Sarah had a child in his old age and he gave everything to that child and da-da-da-da, and he made me take an oath. Now, in the wording of the oath later on, he says the following. So my master made me take an oath saying, Lotikach ishal divni. Now I'm going to keep them both on the screen. Mibnot ha-Kanani, so far same words, Asher Anochi Yoshev Be'artso, which is different. And some of the Rishonim identify, note that difference, and say that what the Eved was trying to do was to convince the family that Avraham was really interested in the people from his old country, and he didn't want to have somebody from the country he was in. Okay, and therefore Be'artso. But that's not what Avraham said. And the text is quite clear that Avraham said, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bikirbo, in his midst, which you could say is another way of saying Be'artso, but it's not. Okay, so we have to see what that's about. But I want to kind of focus our first bit of attention here on what is wrong with Kanani girls. Why doesn't Avram want Yitzchak to marry a Kanani girl? So there are three broad approaches taken by the Rishonim. When I say broad, because each one is nuanced, but three broad approaches taken by the Rishonim as to what's wrong with Kanani girls. One of them is well known. It happens to be a minority, meaning it's not the mainstream approach, which is that the Kananim behave in disgusting manners. They're involved in fetishism, they're pagans, they're unethical, they're whatever it is, they're bad people. And then you have different nuskot of what they're bad people. That's one version. There is another version, which is that they are cursed. And that goes back to Noah, which means it's not necessarily about their behavior, but about their status. They're cursed, and our job is to be blessed. Cursed and blessed don't mix. There's yet a third approach that I'm going to hold off for a minute, and I'll show it to you because we'll take a look at all the approaches. But I want to show you something curious that happens in the Midrash. The Midrash Rabbah here, Breishit Rabbah, has one comment on the B'not HaKanani. It does not say any of those things that we just said, but rather, he's hiro al B'not aner eshkol umamre. What was Avraham warning the slave not to do? Don't let Yitzchak marry the daughters of Aner Eshkol and Mamre. Who are Aner Eshkol and Mamre? They are Avraham's neighbors who are his treaty partners who went to war with him against the kings. And he mentions that in his negotiations with Melech Sdom, that they get their portion of the spoils, right? So Aner Eshkol and Mamre are Avraham's circle of friends. Now, what's the Midrash trying to say here? So Mirkin, in his commentary on the Midrash, states that afilu, he adds in the word afilu, meaning you can't marry any Kanani, even the ones who you're friends with. But I don't think that addition is necessarily in place. And you're going to see this Midrash come up again. Now, we're going to first take a look at a few other incidents in Bereishit, because it can't really happen after Bereishit. We talk about the issue of marrying Kanani girls. It can't happen afterwards because first we obliterate them, and then all that's left is Shimshon marrying a Plishti, and et cetera, and then the Shlomo, but then that's not Kananim anymore. All right, so now when we get to the point where Esav gets married, by Esav ben Arbaim Shana, vayikach ishat Yehudit bat Beri Achiti vat Basemat bat Elon Achiti. So he marries two girls that are Chitiot, which means they are perhaps, depending how you read Kanani, is Kanani the name of a tribe or a broad generic name for all these tribes? They may be Kananiot. Now, why did Esav marry them? Is Esav trying to form some sort of a financial or trade connection with the Chitim or these cute girls? Why does he take them? We don't know. But we know that Vatiana Morat Ruachli Yitzchak Oli Rivka. Yitzchak and Rivka don't like them. Now, why don't they like them? We're not told. So now, when we roll to the end of that particular story, we see the following. Vatomer Rivka Oli Yitzchak, Katzti V'chayayim Neim Notchet. I can't stand these daughters-in-law of mine. Im Lokeach Yaakov Yisham Im Notchet Ka'ele Mibnot Ha'aretz Lamali Chayim. Now, look very carefully at what Rivka says. You have to remember that this is a smokescreen. Because what Rivka is really trying to do is to get Yitzchak to voluntarily let Yaakov leave home and go to Lavan. And the excuse that she gives is to complain about the daughters-in-law. And she says, if Yaakov marries someone like that, I'll put my head in the oven. Now, what is she, look at the word she's saying. Is she saying, if Yaakov marries a Kanani girl, my life is not worth living? Lama lichayim? Or is she saying, if Yaakov takes wives like these two losers, then I have no reason to live? Which means that Benot Haaretz, who perhaps are willing to marry these outsiders, these Ivrim, maybe are losers. Maybe. And if the other ones who are making themselves available, I don't want. Could be. Now notice what happens here. Yitzchak calls Yaakov, what's his first command to him? Lo tikach isha mibenot Kanan. So his read or his what he does with the transformation that he makes from Rivka's words is to move from don't marry anybody like your sisters-in-law who walk around with big L's on their head because they're losers. Rather, he turns it into don't marry Benot Kanan. Rather, kum lech paden aram beit avetu alavi imecha. V'kacha misham misham no lavan achi imecha. Now, where does Yitzchak get this idea from? Because, by the way, there's a big world out there somewhere between Canaan and Haran. So the simplest read of it is that Yitzchak says, okay, I agree with Rivka that the local girls didn't work out very well. And so as long as we're going to marry from far from outside, he should do what I did. I went to Haran. I didn't go. The slave went for me. But I married somebody from Haran, so go back and get another wife from Haran. So there's nothing inherent in these psukim that says that these girls in Canaan are no good, but rather the daughters-in-law are no good, and perhaps any girls who would be willing to marry into these outsiders' tribe are no good. Because we have to remember that it's always a funny thing about intermarriage. You know, we go, och and they, how can I think about a Jewish kid marrying a non-Jewish girl? Until we find out that the non-Jewish family is not so happy either. This is the other side. We have to think, like, how do you think an upstanding Chiti family is going to think about their daughter getting married to this outsider as opposed to one of us? Not so clear. In any case, he sends him off to Lavan. Now, notice what happens in the Midrash again. When the Midrash clearly is borrowed from the first place, but the Midrash Rabbah on this Pasuk, when Yitzchak tells Yaakov not to marry local girls, which is odd because we haven't heard of Aner Eshkol Mamre in Yitzchak's lifetime. But nonetheless, now, so with the Midrash here, if we're to read it on this Pasuk, seems to mean is that he warned him against marrying any of the local girls, any of the ones who are part of the sort of extended tribe or sort of our friends, maybe. And then Mirkan again says the same thing here. Afilu, you know, even the ones we're close with. But again, I don't think that's necessary. Okay, there's two more instances where this shows up in Bereishit. In Yehuda leaves his brothers after the Mechirat Yosef, or before, unclear when it happened. I said the Ralbag there. But at some point, Yehuda moves on his own. He moves to Timnah, which, by the way, curiously, is going to later be smack in the middle of Nachalat Yehuda. There's a lot there. Vahi ba'itahi vayered Yehuda me'itachav in source 7 ve'it ad ish adulame ushmo chira. So he becomes friends with the man from Adulam, later famous in David's flight, and the guy's name is Chira. Vayasham Yehuda bat ish Kanaani, and I'm put on the spot. Rashi says, "What's Kanaani? Kanaani doesn't mean a Canaanite; it means a merchant." Ushmo Shua. This guy, his name is Shua, and he's got a daughter, and Yehuda likes her. Takes her as a wife, and he has relations with her. Okay. Now, interesting is that that's how Rashi, what Rashi does with Kanaan, because Rashi's bothered. How could it be that Yehuda would marry a Kanaani girl, based on what we've seen so far? But Unklos doesn't do that. Unklos says, and Unklos is comfortable shifting things when they needed. V'chama taman Yehuda, bar, sorry, this is Targum Neofiti, which is even more likely to adopt the Midrashic stance. V'chama taman Yehuda barta digvar Kanaanai ushmo Shua. He sees a girl who's the daughter of a Kanaani guy named Shua, and he marries her. And this is now, Unklos for sure says, but that I think actually Unklos may say Tigre here, but this is a Midrash that's given to Midrashic inclusions. Now, what's interesting is the Midrash Rabbah here actually takes a pasuk in Perek Bet of Malachi, Bagda Yehuda v'gam chilal kodesh Hashem, and I saw the parts of the pasuk are made big, and reads it as follows in introducing the story of Yehuda and his wife. Amar le kafarta Yehuda, shakarta Yehuda, toivan estah b'Yisrael, you've done a terrible thing, ki chilel Yehuda, nestah chulin, aseita chulin Yehuda. You made yourself chulin, right? Which is when you go and marry this Kanaani girl. Evidently, that's what the Midrash is reading. Which means this Kanaani girl is not the daughter of a merchant. She's a Kanaani girl. And this Midrash is taking the position that Yehuda, you've defiled yourself by marrying a Kanaani girl. And the whole story, of course, ends terribly. Er dies, Onan dies. Yehuda ends having relations with his daughter-in-law. But of course, from there comes Mashiach. So we're all good. Now, there's one other place where Kanaan shows up in this context. And that's in the genealogical record of the family that comes down to Mitzrayim. You know, the list of 70. 69, 66, 70, and of course the 275. Uvnei Shimon. We got Bnei Reuven, now Bnei Shimon. Who are Bnei Shimon? Yimuel, V'yamin, V'oav, V'yachid, V'tzochar, V'shaul, Ben HaKna'anit. Which means that Shimon has married or had relations with a Kanaani girl, and they have a kid named Shaul. What are we going to do with that? So watch where the Targum that we call it Pseudo-Jonathan, Targum Yuchas Leonatan, it's a very late Mea Targum, reads as follows, Uvnoi de Shimon, the son of Shimon, Tzohar, v'Shaul, watch what I do with Shaul, who's Zimri, you know who Zimri is? Zimri is the member of Shevet Shimon, a couple hundred years down the line, who sins at Baal Peor. De Avar Ovda de Kanoi de Shittim, he behaved like he did Kanani behavior. So now, what's Shaul ben HaKananit? Shaul is not Shaul. Shaul is Zimri. And Kanani is not the son of a Kanani girl, but rather somebody who behaves like a Kanani later on in Shittim. Okay? What does Rashi do with ben HaKananit? Because here's the problem. Either you say that, because nobody's going to say Kananit is a merchant woman. So either it means something different, and it's not really a woman who's a Kanani, or Shimon did something wrong and married a Kanani girl, or maybe marrying a Kanani girl is not so bad. We have to see. What does Rashi say about Kananit? Ben Dinahaya, Shenivala leKanani. So what happened? Shimon's sister, Dina, who by the way is a full sister, remember that, Achot Minaim also, was raped or had relations with a Kanani, that's Shechem, and therefore she's called Kananit now. And Shimon had relations with her and gave birth to Shaul. We certainly have some problems with this. Brother, sister? Okay. Now, Ben HaKananit, watch what Ibn Ezra says. Le'ed kineshea shvatim ayu aramiot, mitzriot, vadomiot, midyaniot. In other words, Ibn Ezra says, the very fact that one kid out of the 50 plus who are mentioned here in the list is identified as Ben HaKani proves to you that everybody else didn't marry Kani women. And even Shimon himself only married a Kani girl or had a relationship with a Kani girl after he had other kids, right? The Radak says the same thing. They all observed Avram's aminiversions to the slave, and they did not marry Kani girls, and he is the one who did. Shimon gets scraped over the coals on this. All right. However, there are other takes on this. There are other takes, not necessarily on Sho'ob and Akranit, though there are, but more on the whole problem with Kanani girls, which is what we're focusing on. So to summarize until now, and then we're going to see. We've seen essentially four places where the issue of a Kanani woman comes up. We see it when Avram administers the oath and the slave repeats it. We see it in the story of Rivka and Yitzchak and Rivka's reaction to Esav's wives and what Rivka says. We've seen it in the case of Yehuda. And by the way, in all three cases, it is not abundantly clear what the problem is. Meaning, we don't know why Avraham says, don't marry a Kanani girl. Don't take Kanani wife. We don't know that Rivka and Yitzchak are upset because they're Kananiyot, but maybe because of their own behavior, and maybe the other girls were available. And we don't know that Yehuda did anything wrong. It's only when we get to Sho'ob ben HaKranit that we have a little bit of a problem. But when we look back now to what the issue was with marrying Kanani girls, let's take a look. The Bechor Shor gives a third approach. Remember I told you the three mainstream approaches are, one, that the Kanani behaved badly. Two, and that's sort of the Rivka Yitzchak thing. Two, that the Kanani are cursed. All right, and we're going to see that right now in the Radak. And then there's a third approach. The third approach you can see here in the word in the Bechor Shor. He says the following. Normally, when people move into a country, they dafka want to marry local girls. Why? Because by marrying locally, you can inherit land locally. And you would say that, by the way, in the modern era, when somebody immigrates, the second or third generation wants to marry other people who are local because that integrates them into the culture. But he says, Kamosha Asa Esav. And that, by the way, is a big piece of the importance of Perek Lamed Vav, which people generally skip over. It's that last chapter in Vayishlach with all the names of Esav's kids, to which most people say, who cares, is that why did Esav marry a third wife, Olivama, who was Mibnot HaChori? Because that got him an in to inherit Har Seir. Aval ani eini tzarich, meaning Avram is saying to his slave, I don't need such a thing. Why? This is the third approach. There's nothing wrong with Kanani women. They're fine. And they're not cursed. But I don't want Yitzhak to marry her, because if Yitzhak marries her, then how is he going to get land? How is he going to eventually become a lord of the land? Through marriage. And that, in a sense, diminishes, not in a sense, it absolutely diminishes from the gift of the land that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave. Now you see in the Radak the second direction, Kizera Kanan Arur, Zaro Baruch, or Zari Baruch, right? And then you see the first approach in the Ktava Kabbalah. He's not the first one to say it. He's, of course, 19th century, but he says, Ki Akranim Ayu Ra'im B'midot V'asim, they were terrible people, behaviors. He talks about the impact of parents on kids and their behavior and Midot, etc. But you see, for instance, Shadal takes the same approach that the Bechor Shor took. She'im Ayam Mitchaten Bahem, Shuv lo yitachen liYisrael lo risha kani me'artzo acharei heyotam achim. He takes the same take, but he modifies it. He adds to it. He says, think about this. If Yitzchak marries a Kanani girl, then eventually when we return to the land, we can't dispossess the Kanani because they're family. So again, the issue is not who the Kanani are in their behavior, but just the problem is the Kanani are locals, and therefore we can't marry them. The whole Moshe takes the same approach that the Ibn Ezra took, that the Radak took, which is that Noah cursed Canaan, and he cursed, you can't be connected. All right. So that's one instructive note that Ibn Ezra puts here, which is Nichtava Zota Parasha. And he's referring now to Esav and his wives. He said, well, who cares who Esav married? Shishmuri Yisrael Mitchatein B'Kanan. It was written, so we should be careful not to marry Kanan. In other words, we read Esav married Kanani girls, and his parents didn't like them, and that created all sorts of disharmony in the family. That should be, kind of warn us not to marry Kanani girls. All right. I want to point out one little fly in this ointment, which is in a Midrash, but I cannot find the original Midrash, but it shows up in the Alkut Shimoni, which is a later collection of Midrashim, late medieval collection. In the context of Yaakov's reaction to the news that Yosef was dead, which was, I guess we call it fake news, but I haven't heard that in a couple of years. But his reaction was, of course, to mourn, and his family tried to console him, and he refused to be consoled. There's a strange phrase in there that we've talked about in a different context, which is Vayakumu chol banav v'chol benotav v'nachamo. All of his sons and daughters got up to console him, and he couldn't be consoled. Who are his daughters? What daughters? We know Dina. So in the past, I've proposed the argument that Yaakov actually had more daughters and had more granddaughters than the list says, and why they're on the list, and that's the Netziv, and that's and others who make that suggestion in different ways on the list that's in Shadal, also on the list that's in Memvav, the statistic probability of having 70, 69 in your bloodline, of whom only two are female, is really highly unlikely. In any case, and there are arguments for why their names aren't there. But take a look at this Midrash. In other words, he's saying that Shvatim all had sisters, and they married their sisters. Doesn't say necessarily the twins thing. They married their sisters. By the way, it could have been half-sisters, meaning it could be that Reuven marries somebody who's a daughter of Zilpah or whatever, and they married them. And that's why it says his sons and his daughters, because there's a bunch of daughters. But around the point he's making is there's a lot more girls around the house than you think. Rabbi Nechemya Omer Kananiotayu. Meaning, who are these daughters? These are Kananiot. Now, does that mean Avad, like Shfachot? Or does it mean that that's who the brothers marry? Right? So it leaves that as an opening. But I want to make a different suggestion here, to understand what Avraham's issue was, and build it off of the Bechor Shor's direction, and look specifically at this difference between Bekirbo and Be'artso. What is Avraham's mission? Let's look Begadol. What's Avraham's job? Avraham's job is to present a revolutionary approach to understanding God, man, and the universe, everything. It's huge. And Avram cannot do it in familiar territory. And however you want to interpret what Lech Lecha Me'artzecha is about, a piece of that puzzle is you've got to go somewhere new. And he goes somewhere, and critically, Akan Niyaz Ba'aretz, he comes to a place that's populated by others. He is the other. He is a nomad wandering through as a different person who is separate. And the success of his mission, to some extent, depends on his ability to ingratiate himself, and I mean that in the most laudatory way, with the locals. And he does. He makes britot with Aner Shkol and Mamre, and he has meetings with Malki Tzedek. He becomes a local military hero. And what do the people say to him in this week's Parsha when he comes to buy the kever? You're a princely man, a godly man. They all look up to him. But it also depends on him always being an other. He always has to be an outsider. He has to maintain a position of being outside. And that's why he says to the slave, Shelo tikachi shalivni mibnota kna'ani asher anochi yoshev bikirbo. Meaning Yitzchak cannot marry one of the local girls. These are the people I live with. And that's the Midrash. The Midrash says it explicitly. Dafka benot aner oshkolam amrei, the people that I'm friends with, the people I'm treaty partners with. Yitzchak cannot marry with them. Why? What's wrong? Just think about it. Calls man that you are an outsider. You have a different message. Your distinct message stands there. The people who don't like the message hate you, and the people who take to the message will become your followers, as long as you're an outsider. When Jews first came to Los Angeles, they were about as welcome here as they were as anywhere else. Not very. They were welcomed officially. But the big country club that was built in L.A. was restricted, and Jews couldn't go in. You know what Jews did? They started their own country club. And in those days, as much as people might not have been that observant and might not that have been dedicated and certainly weren't spending a lot of time learning, they stayed Jewish. And they stayed Jewish mainly because they didn't have a choice. And they also stayed Jewish because the only person they could marry was Jewish. And the reality was they maintained the Jewish identity. Today, they can go anywhere. They can be involved with anything. And the Jewish identification is severely down. And the rate of intermarriage here is about 70%. That means of every 10 weddings where one of the people is Jewish, the other one's not. Imagine that. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't endeavor to have equal rights and equal access wherever we go, but all you have a chutzpah. That's a prize that carries with it a big danger. What was Abraham's status before Kinyan Maarat HaMachpelah? He was an outsider. He was a separate person. And as a separate person, for instance, he could not own land. That was one of the big things. You can't be a landowner if you're an outsider. What does Avraham do in that famous scene with Ephron at the beginning of this week's parasha? He ends up becoming a member of the tribe. You cannot, by Hittite law, by Mesopotamian law, you cannot own land unless you're a member of the tribe. And by the way, what are the tribesmen, the members of the city council, Amaretz, so that is. And what does Ephron say? They said, take it, we're happy to give it to you. Avraham insists on buying it. Because what's Avram really doing? He's actually becoming one of the land. This is the approach that he's now taken after all the years of the promise of Zarcha Natati Taretz, and he doesn't have one dunam. This is his approach. He buys his way into the family. And that's where the trouble starts. So what does Avram say? Now that I'm a member of the family, and now that I have one son, Yitzchak, who doesn't really interact much. He's in Beersheba out in the desert contemplating whatever. He's a recluse. I need to get somebody who's going to be active. That's the whole search for a, if you will, an Avrahama. Think about the request he makes of the slave, a girl who's willing to leave family behind, leave everything behind for a vision. And that's why the slave's test is a test of hospitality, looking for Avrahama. And therefore, she has to be an outsider. Because if Yitzchak marries a local girl, the whole mission is finished. He's now a member of the club. He's now included. He's now inside. And so that's why Avram says, do not take any of the Kanani Asher Anochi Bekirbo. The slave isn't interested in giving that message across. And he wants to make it about patriotism and about civic connection. And therefore he changes it to Barzo. What happens with Rivka and Yitzchak? It's very simple. That if Yaakov marries one of these kind of girls, the ones who are making themselves available to us, like Esav took, I'm not interested. Which is, by the way, why does who does Esav end up marrying finally? A daughter of Yishmael, who's also on the outside. Right? In the meantime, Yehuda now is a whole different era. Yehuda comes in, and Yehuda's strategy, we talked about this a number of years ago, is Dafka to become part of the land and a lord of the land. And so he takes a Batish Kanani. And by the way, significantly, we never hear her name because she's not that important. She doesn't play that role. And Yehuda maintains his position as a separate person and as distinct as the other. And so by that time, they are marrying Kanani girls. And so therefore, Shimon has among his wives Kanani girl, not necessarily anything bad, and their kid is named Shaul. And that's what they call him, Shaul ben Akranit. That was his identity. So we've looked at over the course of the last 35 minutes has been of the relevant sources in Sefer Bereishit that deal with the issue of marrying Canaanite girls, specifically with an eye towards understanding why Avram administered this oath to his servant that not to take a Canaanite girl. And I suggested that the issue was not about any inherent blemish in the Canaanite lifestyle or even the curse of Noah on them, but rather because marrying a Canaanite girl would then erase whatever distinctions there are between Avram and the locals, thus, shall we say, diminishing, if not completely curtailing, his opportunity to continue his mission.